Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Obama administration is still trying to find the right sell for its healthcare overhaul. Today, the pitch went directly to the loyal opposition. Meanwhile, another government program was so popular, it has to end. Maybe health reform just needs a catchphrase. Cash for cardiograms? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Marketplace Whiteboard, videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. You can watch them anytime at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 20th day of August. Today, President Barack Obama made the case for his health care overhaul to a fairly skeptical audience, conservative talk radio listeners. After major government interventions in the banking and auto industries, the president is trying to calm fears that a, quote, government takeover of health care is next on his agenda. Joel Rose reports.
Conservative radio host Michael Smirkanish didn't waste much time before asking the question a lot of his listeners want answered.
You know that there's a perception out there that you want it all. You know, you want to be in the banks, you want to be in the automotive industry, and now you want to be in healthcare. Can you address that mindset?
I absolutely can. First of all, look.
President said government involvement with the banking and auto industries started under his Republican predecessor. As for the healthcare system?
I would love the private marketplace to be handling this without any government intervention. The problem is it's not working.
As talk radio hosts go, Smirkanish is a moderate. He even voted for Obama, and his questions were polite, in contrast to what you might hear elsewhere. The callers were respectful, too, like Susan from New York.
We're very concerned that most of the money will actually go, instead of taking care of people, it will go to, the cost of administering a huge government bureaucracy.
The success of Obama's health care proposals may depend on winning over people like Susan. That's according to Democratic media strategist Peter Fenn.
One thing that he learned throughout the long two-year campaign was that you have to go to the middle, you have to go to those who may initially disagree with you, you have to persuade people.
But on his signature issue, the president is finding it hard to be heard above the din. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
If you've got an old gas guzzler in the garage, listen up. The government's Cash for Clunkers program will end Monday night. That means you have one more weekend to take advantage of the $4,500 rebate for trading up to a new set of wheels. On top of that, some dealers are clunking out early because of a reported delay in reimbursements. As Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington, car companies themselves are coming to the dealer's rescue.
The $3 billion Cash for Clunkers rebate has been very, very good for car dealers.
Of all the stimulus programs, it's probably gotten the quickest, fastest reaction in the retail marketplace. We're running almost twofold what we normally would run during the month of August.
Mike Martin runs Chevrolet and Saturn dealerships in Manassas, Virginia. The problem is he's still waiting for the government to reimburse him for $300,000 in rebates that he's given to his customers.
So out of over 70 vehicles, I've been paid on two.
The government is promising to speed it up, but some dealers have dropped out of the program, claiming they can't afford to give out any more rebates. To keep anxious dealers from bailing out, GM, Chrysler, and Toyota will front them the reimbursements until the government money comes through. The cash advances are worth it to the car companies. To replace inventory, GM will build 60,000 more cars this year. Carmakers would love for Congress to extend the rebates, but Jeff Schuster, a forecaster with J.D. Power, says that risks artificially overheating the market and setting it up for a slump when it's over.
I think there's a lot said for keeping it a shorter-term program, get the money through the economy and get people in more fuel-efficient vehicles, and then let's let market conditions take back over.
Due to the Cash for Clunkers rebates, J.D. Power has raised its forecast for domestic car sales this year by 300,000 to 10.3 million. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Spain's second-largest bank, BBVA, has reportedly won an auction for a Texas bank that was on the verge of collapse. The purchase is expected to be formalized by the end of the week. If it goes through, It would be the first failed bank to be taken over by a foreign company since this financial crisis began. And as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, this isn't likely to be the last deal of its kind.
Here in the U.S., the banking industry may look like a mess, but others see our distressed banks as bargains.
That presents a wonderful buying opportunity for foreigners.
That's Charles Geist, a finance professor at Manhattan College.
Now, with the crisis, a lot of the regional banks and the local banks have become very attractive. Their prices are under duress, and some of them have quite good asset bases. It's also a very good way for these foreign banks to finally enter the American market.
The Spanish bank BBVA already has a presence in the U.S. In recent years, it bought banks with branches in Alabama, California, and Texas. It's also one of the dominant bankers in Mexico. Geist says Hispanics in both countries make attractive clients.
It becomes a natural to have institutions where people eventually will be able to bank on either side of the border.
But BBVA is not just focused on Spanish-speaking clients. Richard Melville is with the trade publication American Banker.
You would absolutely be underestimating them if you thought that this was simply about Hispanic marketing.
He says the Spanish bank has grande ambitions.
They want to be one of the bigger retail banks in North America.
Executives with BBVA told Melville that U.S. banks are destined for consolidation, and BBVA wants a piece of the paella. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a third straight session of gains. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, the first provisions of the Credit Card Reform Act are coming online. Among the changes, credit card companies have to mail bills at least 21 days before their due date, and they've got to give you 45 days notice before changing interest rates or fees. Of course, the industry started making its own changes to card agreements as soon as the law passed. That is some cause for concern for cardholders, including commentator Rob Walker.
I'm a deadbeat, and I'm worried. I know you're sick of hearing people confess their financial sins these days, but I'm a deadbeat to credit card companies. That is, a customer who doesn't revolve their debt and therefore never pays interest. In the real world, this is responsible behavior, but in the card issuer's world, it means you're not doing enough for their bottom line. I'm actually worse than a typical deadbeat. I'm one of those people with a no-fee, cash-back credit card who makes sure I get my $250 rebate check every year. I keep track of my points so they don't expire, and when I cash them in, I pass on the gift cards and the merchandise. I want the money. That's why I'm worried. Deals like this are starting to go away. Card companies put up with deadbeats because we're more than balanced out by less vigilant customers who end up revolving their debt and racking up fees. Now the credit card business is being prodded to change its ways. In the big picture, that's a good idea. But forget the big picture. What about me? My card's reward program hasn't changed yet, but in this economic environment, it makes absolutely no sense for the issuer to keep it up, so I know my days are numbered. And the truth is, it's not even the money that I'll miss. It's what that money represents. Most of the time, I'm not exactly a paragon of penny pinching, so getting my rebate is a once-a-year moment of feeling like a savvy consumer. But what I really love is extracting a trophy from an industry that is among the supreme enemies of thrift. Like everybody else, I pretty much think of credit card companies as pests who fill my mailbox with misleading pitches and bullies who profit from enabling shoppers to go into debt. So yeah, the couple of $100, that's nice. But the idea of this huge, money-grubbing institution paying me to use its convenient product, that's, yes, priceless.
Rob Walker writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. We want to hear from you. Write to us at marketplace.org. If you thought this country's economic problems were bad, at least we are not Iceland. You may remember its financial system didn't just near collapse last winter, it completely imploded. Well, Iceland's parliament is about to vote on a massive financial package. The plan is to repay more than $5 billion to British and Dutch savers. Sounds kind of like chump change, unless you calculate that since Iceland only has 300,000 people, it's equivalent to asking us in the U.S. to fork over $4 trillion for one bank. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the story.
Protest by percussion. Icelanders demonstrate outside their parliament in distinctive fashion, banging pots and pans and even gongs. The din is a way of venting disgust.
The general feeling among the public is that we've been had, we've been tricked, and we are innocent victims.
Former Foreign Minister Jon Baldvin Hannibalsson, he says many Icelandic taxpayers do not believe they should pick up the entire tab for the collapse of the online bank Icesave.
They are called upon to pay huge debts, and they ask themselves, well, did we take on the loans? Did we ask for the loans? Are we responsible for the loans? No, they were not.
When Icesave failed last fall, foreign depositors, mostly British and Dutch, stood to lose a fortune. The British and Dutch government stepped in and compensated their citizens in full. Now they're pressuring Iceland to reimburse them, dropping hints that the country's application to join the EU and even its access to IMF loans could be in jeopardy. Magnus Arni Skulason is a leading critic of the repayment deal.
Icelanders in general find it unfair that they're paying for the mistakes of, well, Icelandic bankers and financial supervisory authorities, both in Iceland and in Europe.
A protester in Reykjavik rails against the small group of Icelandic bankers that have ruined the country. Termites, he calls them. They've eaten the fabric of our society. That rhetoric is not too far removed from reality, says Jon Danielsson, a lecturer at the London School of Economics. He says the Icesave debt alone would be a crippling burden.
Iceland is by far the worst affected economy in the global crisis. Its economy is spiraling down continually, and taking on that very sizable burden is quite likely to cause the government of Iceland to end in bankruptcy.
Not everyone is quite so gloomy. Iceland does have more than 20 years to pay. And under the plan the parliament is voting on, repayment will depend on the performance of the Icelandic economy. Dragana Ignatovic is with IHS Global Insight. She says the Icelandic government certainly thinks that the Icesave repayment could be a way forward.
They firmly believe that making restitution of the money paid out will help rebuild confidence in the economy and will show that Iceland is being held accountable for the problems it has caused.
But there's no guarantee that doing the right thing will bring back investors. In a recent survey of large European financial institutions, 90% said they were unlikely to put money into Iceland ever again. 93% said they're prepared to sue the country to recover the money they lost in Iceland's banking collapse. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, making tough choices with tight budgets.
The day after the company said they were going to cut our pay, I immediately dropped my contribution to my retirement fund down to zero to free up that cash.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets edged higher today. The Dow added 70 points, about 0.75%, to close at 9,350. The Nasdaq rose 19 points, just over 1%, to finish at 1989. And the S&P 500 climbed 10 points, about 0.1%, to wrap up trading at 10.07. Investors perked up after Starbucks announced it was cutting the price of some coffee drinks and raising the price of others. Shares picked up more than 0.5%. News the Cash for Clunkers program would end Monday didn't seem to put the brakes on one of its main beneficiaries. Shares of Ford revved up about 0.4%. Bonds rose, and the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.42%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The National Association of Realtors issues its monthly report on sales of existing homes. Economists from around the world are in Jackson Hole, Wyoming for an annual retreat of the Federal Reserve. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke will speak about the financial crisis. And 50 years ago, Hawaii became state number 50 to join the Union. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Project Runway is hoping its hems are straight and stray threads snipped after a messy off-season move to the Lifetime Channel. The reality show hit finally left Bravo after a courtroom fight with the channel's parent company, NBC Universal. It debuts its sixth season tonight from Los Angeles instead of New York. We asked our senior business correspondent Bob Moon to perch on his stool and judge whether Lifetime's pricey takeover of the show is not only haute couture, but a winning strategy.
One of you will be named the winner. One of you will be out. Let's start the show.
Lifetime reportedly is paying close to $1 million an episode compared to the $600,000 per show deal that Bravo started with. And at the University of Buffalo, pop culture expert Elaine Rapping says that makes this a big gamble since it's much harder for a network to buy brand loyalty these days.
You know, in the old days, people would turn on NBC and there would be a flow of programs and they would just watch the whole night and know what they were watching. That isn't true anymore.
On the other hand, NBC Universal Chief Jeff Zucker testified during the court battle that Project Runway was one of the most central programs to his entire company. That doesn't surprise Robert Thompson at Syracuse University's Center for Television and Popular Culture. He says a show like this can be make or break.
Look what South Park did for Comedy Central. Look what Queer Eye for the Straight Guy did for Bravo. I mean, half the people didn't even know they had Bravo on their cable boxes until that show got so much attention that they found the show and then they saw promos for other Bravo shows and all the rest of it.
Essentially, Thompson argues Lifetime could use the show to sell its other programs, but it had better have good shows lined up now. And given that this is Project Runway's sixth season, there's something else to worry about.
The question is Lifetime getting Project Runway just at the time that we're reaching the end of the runway?
In our Project Runway tradition, make it work.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The city of Las Vegas, Sin City, was for years one of the fastest-growing metropolitan areas in the country. People flocked to good jobs at casinos. Anyone could get a house. The odds of a decent lifestyle were in your favor. At least that was the story. The growth of Vegas largely matched the trajectory of the housing bubble, a seemingly endless explosion of building and buying and big payouts. But when the bubble burst, so did Sin City's economy. Joel Stein writes about it in this week's Time magazine. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is very exciting.
Give us a bit of an economic snapshot of what Vegas is like right now. I was actually there a few months ago, and it was awfully slow.
What were you doing in Vegas?
Oh, I can't tell.
Wow. See, that's the good thing. The place is full of people like you. So when you walk around the casinos and the pools, it's pretty full because the prices have dropped so much, particularly the hotel rooms. But, you know, you don't have to go very far to see a bunch of unfinished hotels that are just going to sit there forever, cranes that are going nowhere. And if you drive outside the strip, the foreclosure rate is unbelievable.
One of the things you realize as you read the article is how much of a microcosm Vegas was for the entire bust across the country. Talk to us a little bit about how pre-recession Vegas really was symbolic of pre-recession America and its mindset.
Well, the great thing is you can go to Vegas and you can see the moment when the boom stopped. Because you can see the last house in the housing project, or you can see, you know, the level of the hotel where they stopped. So it almost feels like there's just a day when all the credit left, really, and everyone just had to stop. And that's when the unemployment rate goes from like 3 point something percent to 12% really quickly.
Does the new Vegas, the post-bust Vegas, at all represent the rest of the bust?
Yeah, it's interesting to go around Vegas because I thought after hearing all this stuff about the new economy and thrift that the hotels would kind of be changing and, you know, the rooms would look different or they'd go back to the cheap buffets. But they're holding ground. They assume that this is another, you know, small cycle. America will go, you know, back to just how it was. People get used to bad times and they don't really want to change their lives.
But how can you not change a gambling habit when you have no money?
Well, you've obviously never been to Vegas.
Come with no money, leave with even less.
Exactly. It's the only city I know of where they make a lot of money and produce absolutely nothing.
In the article, you also talk about folks who are capitalizing on the wasteland. Can you give us a couple examples of that?
Yeah, there's a lot of people who have already figured out how to make money on the bust in Vegas. I think a lot of real estate agents have figured out how to short homes, basically move people from a home where they're underwater and have them let the banks deal with that problem and buy a new home. So I think there's already real estate agents out there who are making a decent profit off of this. There are already casino operators who are back in business. Like Phil Ruffin bought Treasure Island really cheap off of MGM, who was pouring all their money into City Center and was just desperate for some cash.
Yeah. You know, the excess, the greed, the expansion, it really brings to mind visions of Rome.
Yeah.
Have we seen an empire truly fall here? Can Vegas bounce back?
It looks like it's been sacked because you walk into these foreclosed homes and all the copper wiring has been stripped and all the appliances are taken out and people angrily kind of destroy things or throw paint on the walls. I don't know what happened when Rome fell, but people are going to party until the thing burns. And I think there's at least one cycle left in this country and certainly in Vegas.
And did you contribute to that when you were there?
I didn't have time to gamble because I was actually reporting, but I couldn't let that pass. So I made one sports bet on hockey. And sadly for Vegas, I won. So I think Vegas was down about, you know, $300 or $400 on my visit.
Joel Stein is a Time Magazine contributor, and his article, Less Vegas, is the cover story this week. It's been fun, Joel. Thanks.
Thank you.
As the recession drags on in Vegas and everywhere else, more businesses are trying to cut costs without necessarily cutting staff. A recent survey by outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas found that more than a quarter of companies polled are slashing or freezing salaries. Others are requiring some employees to take temporary unpaid leaves. From WBUR in Boston, Monica Brady-Meyerhoff tells us how some of those affected are learning to live with less.
Some people have taken their salary cut with a little irony.
Hello.
Members of the largest union at the Boston Globe held a cookout dubbed Farewell to Fair Wages when the paper's owner cut their salaries by nearly a quarter. Reporter Scott Allen saw several hundred dollars a week vanish from his paycheck.
The day after the company said they were going to cut our pay, I immediately dropped my contribution to my retirement fund down to zero to free up that cash to make up part of it.
Some of Allen's pay cut has since been restored, but he's still not putting away as much money for retirement as he used to. It's probably no surprise newspapers like The Globe have had to cut salaries to stay afloat. Even before the recession, declining ad sales robbed them of much of their revenue. But HR departments are also taking out the salary shears at law firms, high-tech companies, factories, and ad agencies. Tom Kohan teaches management at MIT's business school. He says the wage cuts are the worst since the Great Depression.
It's more prevalent now than it has been in any recession that's been recorded.
Economists say more reductions are likely if the recession persists. Kathy Lemus of Cambridge says she can't afford to lose much more. She sells Hondas at a local dealership. With cuts in her base pay and a drop in commissions, she's making about a quarter less than a year ago. She says she's stressed and not sleeping well.
There are months that you don't even break even on the rent, the bills, the food. So it's tough.
To make up for the shortfall, she's running up credit card debt and taking out loans. Lemus has an 8-year-old son she's caring for alone.
When you ask him, why doesn't mommy have money for games? Because she's got to put a roof over my head, and she's got to pay the electricity, and she's got to put food on the table. So that's coming out of my 8-year-old. It's hard to hear.
In this recession, not even executives are immune from a pay cut. Fran Kelly is CEO of Arnold Worldwide, an advertising agency in Boston. In April, he cut all salaries at his company by 10%, including his own.
I had more questions about the cut at home than I had here at the office, because that's where my paycheck goes, and that's who is most affected by it.
His wife keeps track of the family finances, and she started cutting the household budget.
We postponed a trip. We're thinking about getting another car. We may buy a nice used car instead of a new car. And even when we're out to dinner, you know, my wife inevitably will order just the appetizer, not the entree.
Others are changing their eating habits, too. Maura Hodge has been temporarily furloughed from her accounting job and lost 80% of her salary. Her husband works, and they have no kids. They've adjusted by putting less money into savings and cooking more at home.
I make all of our own bread. I've tried to make cheese. I make our own yogurt now. And we have a garden, and so that helps cut back on some of the expenses as well.
Hodge says her reduced income has made her appreciate life's simple pleasures. But she's looking forward to fall. That's when she resumes work at her accounting firm and starts getting her full paycheck again. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note for those of you suffering from numb thumb syndrome. All that texting and tweeting and Facebooking got you under a spell, feeling like your computer and cell phone have become your best friends, wondering if you'll ever be able to break the addiction? Well, maybe it's time for a timeout at the Heavens Field Retreat Center near Seattle. CNET reports that for the bargain price of about $15,000, you can spend 45 days unplugged, detoxing from all that social networking. Alternatively, you could just turn the things off and rejoin polite society. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 70 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ gained 19 points, just over 1%. And the S&P added 10 points, about 1.1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, seeking help for spiraling debt.
I don't think it's easy to talk about debt or money in any time. I think that, you know, that's one of the most private, again, it comes, you know, what you make. People associate that with their self-worth.
I'm Tess Viglund. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.